Yes, here we go. So, yes, Anthony.
If you... There's an icon,
yeah,
which looks like a square. If you click on that, it's call layout. And if you click grid view, then it goes from grid view to single person view.
Is that...
If you just wanted one.
I'm happy with where... with I can see an icon and I can see call layout... but yeah. I'm happy with the way it's looking for me, but that might fix it for you, Julie.
Where is it? Where does it live?
At the top of the screen.
If you move,
hover over it.
If you hover over the top of the screen, yeah.
There's a square with three little dots on it. It's gone away now.
Gosh.
I thought about it.
No, that's right. I just got the picture out of the back of your computer, Julie. You can see the rest of your room that way. That's maybe we should have a tour of the house. Now, there we are. There we're back. I can see the cooker.
You can hear my husband at the back door.
I can see a bottle of wine, somebody walking by. So now... sorry, everybody who might be listening to this recording, but we are going to have to leave that with you, Julie. You can still hit.
Turn it round.
You can still hit. There you are.
Can you see that?
Yeah, you're back. You're back. Okay, that's as long as you can all hear. That's all that matters, I think. So I'm now. You know, I've now got to try and get in the zone of the class, even though it looks like I'm talking to myself. So to do that, I'm just going to read that slide and see if I can start to, you know, we can call Heidegger in on this call as well, because at the moment we haven't been able to get his Skype name. So the transposition, this is where we were, and we actually went through this at the end of the last class, but I said we'd start again because this is the beginning of the kind of climacteric of the book that we were reading. So let us attempt a transposition into the occurrence of this distinguishing in which the distinction occurs. Gosh, that's the distinction between being and beings, if you remember. Yeah? I'm working on the assumption, and it's not a bad one, that we don't know what that distinction is. Including me, because it's a sort of form of distinction that, in a way, you have to see it in the moment. It's not a piece of information that you can say, oh, yeah, I know the difference between being and beings. The idea here is we're being drawn into this distinction through the class and through what Heidegger's saying. So we're attempting a transposition into the occurrence of this distinguishing with the intent of discovering the primordial structure of this fundamental occurrence and of comprehending its original or originary an originary unity. Originary being a word I don't think I encountered until I started reading The Phenomenologists. There are some good words like that. The first moment we named addresses us most directly, holding oneself towards something binding. So we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now, and I don't think it really comes clear until we get to the end of this lecture what binding means. But for now, it's to do with the actuality of things. So what we're looking at is how we make, when I say we're talking about the Dasein in us. You know, we were quite unclear in a way and remaining unclear what Dasein really is and who I am and whether I am Dasein or whether there are two things going on here. But in a sense, throughout this course, there have been two things going on. You know, we've looked at the left brain and the right brain as a kind of model of that. That there's a consciousness in the foreground that's always making things explicit and putting things into kind of a logical linguistic format, like I'm doing now, and then there's something in the background which is already there, out of which we are and into which we are speaking. All of phenomenology really is attempting to speak in the foreground about the background. That's kind of the best way I can put it. So it's a strange kind of speaking, because our ordinary language is always in the foreground, talking about the foreground. That's one way of looking at it. So this holding oneself towards something binding is something that's going on in the background that we're attempting to glimpse. And what Heidegger's saying is this binding, and if I can use Bortoff's language, we're trying to go back up the stream into the moment of binding. But if as soon as we start to think about it, again using Bortoff's language, we're already downstream and the binding has already happened. We're bound. We're bound in the sense that we have before us what is actual. And in a way, we're attempting now to go back into the moment where what is actual manifests as actual, and trying to look into what it's manifesting out of. Again, I shouldn't become self-conscious, but you know, when you're with a room full of people, you get a sense of feedback. You think, even if the feedback is incomprehension, but the dance screen doesn't give me any feedback at all. I'm trusting something intelligible is coming across, because this is very, yeah, yes, yeah, it's because it's quite fine. Yes, yeah, yeah, yes, yeah, good. Good, at least the questioning. I hope that's questioning, because in a way, that's Heidegger's motif, is it a continual questioning, a continual holding at bay any sense that you have that you've really fixed what's being said. You know, as soon as in a way you feel you've fixed what's being said, you've left what we're trying to transpose ourselves into. So this holding oneself towards something binding, Heidegger's trying to use language to indicate this moment of the manifestation of the world that is happening all the time. I'm reading again from the slides now in the second paragraph. The binding character of things always already prevails through our comportment. To the extent that we comport ourselves toward beings, and in such comportment, oh gosh, I've lost the sense of that sentence.
Well, it's not just me.
Yes. To the extent that we comport ourselves toward beings, and in such comportment also, not subsequently and by the way, conform to beings without any compulsion, yet nonetheless binding ourselves, but also unbinding ourselves and failing to conform. Yeah, that's that. I did get the emphasis right in that sentence. So this is the what was the phrase there? Are conforming to beings. So Heidegger's talking about, in this moment of manifestation of the world, we're conforming to something that isn't our own projection. And in a way, you know, in a logical sense, because I'd like to sort of pull this model up just to give us something to hang on to, because it goes through the whole lecture, really. You can think of it this way. I'll give you a model to think of it. But it's not, it's just a model. It's the old model that if you've been, I think I've brought up before, about how the brain works, or how current contemporary neuroscience thinks the brain works. The idea that the neocortex, the top layer of the brain, if you look at the signals that are being transmitted there, is in a continual state of prediction. It's basically streaming in, if you think of it, information towards the senses, which is toward the optic nerves, the skin, the ears, all of our sensory systems. What the neocortex is doing is it's streaming towards all of those input sources what it expects is going to be received. And if you just withdraw from your senses, you can use that capacity of the neocortex just to dream and imagine and fantasize and create the world as you would like to see it. And you know, if you go into sensory deprivation, then you can start to experience the world very realistically when you've completely cut off any sensory input whatsoever. So this is a model to think about. What Heidegger's saying is that that's our, if you like, that's our natural state. The neocortex is just streaming its own expectations, its own what it thinks is possible right now. It's just streaming out what it thinks is possible, and what happens is it allows what's coming in through the senses to determine what is possible. So what's coming in through the senses then meets this stream of expectation, and when that stream of what's coming in through the senses meets the stream of our expectation, then there's a binding. The binding is we're allowing that stream of sense to determine what we expect. And in that, when that determination happens, almost involuntarily, we experience that as the being of something actual in front of us. And
is this being recorded?
Is that Alex?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm asking if it's being recorded.
Yes, it is.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm recording it. So do you see there's a model there that's entirely physical, which takes us out of it? I want to be clear. It takes us right out of Heidegger world and gives us something to think about. We can think about brains and neurons and streams of information and stuff coming in through the senses, which entirely objectifies it. But I feel like if I don't give you something like an objective model, then it all just sounds like nonsense. Whereas, in fact, there's an extraordinary parallel here between what Heidegger's saying and how the nervous system functions. And, of course, Heidegger had no idea how the nervous system functions. Right? There was no theory of predictive processing. That's emerged since 2000, really, although there were ideas in the mid-90s. But only as a coherent theory has it emerged maybe in 2010, that sort of. So it's a very recent realization. But it's one of the things that fascinated me about phenomenology is that what current brain science is discovering is what the phenomenologists were describing anyway 100 years ago, which in itself is it's not a kind of a vindication of phenomenology. It's a vindication that actually neuroscience might finally be getting on the right track after a long detour in thinking that we were running some kind of symbolic computer program in the brain, which is finally died away as an idea. But does that picture of the brain give you a better sense of what the what the binding is, because for us in our frontal intelligence, we don't experience it as binding. We're just involuntarily are bound. If you see what I mean, you don't get a choice. I've got some daffodils right in front of me. I don't get a choice of experiencing the daffodils as being actual. They're just there and they're actual. And I think with a lot of discipline, I could maybe start to make them go weird and start to appear like a hallucination. But you can ordinarily, you can't do that, right? The binding has occurred. But we're talking about Dasein itself. We're talking about the moment of the manifestation of world where the binding occurs. Where generally we're not there. We're downstream, where we're just looking at the results of that event. And Heidegger is now attempting to say, right, to take us back into the event. So we don't. It doesn't matter whether the brain science is correct or not. What matters is this some kind of occurrence that we can become attuned to? That's what the transposition is endeavouring to do. So the final...
Can I just ask something?
Yes.
When he says, also unbinding ourselves and failing to conform, is he talking about when we have an expectation of something, like your example of seeing the snake?
Yes.
Which would be a binding, and then looking again and saying, no, it's a stick.
Yes.
Is that unbinding?
Yes. So that's an unbinding of a certain expectation, and a recognition of as he's saying in the slide, of a failing to conform. But again, it all happens like that. It happens almost behind our backs. Something you can sort of see. It's almost like there's a nervous system there that realizes that, because that's literally in the brain. Again, this is another way of looking at it. Literally, what's happening? It appears, right? Bearing in mind this is still theory, is that it's continuously filling in the detail. It's not that the expectation suddenly becomes what's coming in through the senses. What's coming in through the senses is never, in any particular moment, enough to determine for us what's happening. We're always experiencing something like, I mean, I think they think informationally about 80%, if you like, of your perceptual experience right now, you could say, is just sheer expectation. And only around 20%, you could say, was actually determined by what's coming in through the senses. And what's actually coming in through the senses, if you think about it, it's very phenomenological as well. If you completely lost all context whatsoever, you didn't know that you were in a room, you didn't know you were in this class, you didn't know me, you didn't know Skype, you didn't know a computer, you know, as you start taking all the context away, then you slowly you arrive at what the sensory signal is. And if you suddenly just experience the sensory signal in its rawness, which you can't, it would be extremely puzzling what it might mean or represent. But we can't ever experience that. Even, I mean, the closest you can get to it is to look at what's appearing in a CCTV camera on its sensors. But you can't even look at a camera image without making sense of it. Do you know, without immediately trying to work out what it is? There was an illusion in cognitive science once upon a time that's what the brain literally did. It took the raw information from the senses and then attempted in each, like with each frame of information, to kind of construct what's going on from the ground up. To say, oh, what's that colour mean? Oh, yeah, it must mean there's a... Oh, yeah, that looks like a line. Oh, yeah, that's another line. Oh, that must be a square. That must be a square shape. Oh, that must be a tabletop, you know. And it was soon realised that the brain can't do that, even sophisticated as it is. It just doesn't have time. It can't take raw sensory information and work out what it means. It has to... the only way it can make sense of it is to have already... be expecting it, which is our experience of what we call context. That our experience of context is this incredible stream of what's going on in the brain, and what it's expecting. And so it's continuously adjusting itself to what's coming in. So I'm coming back to unbinding and binding. It's actually the way it's understood is there are different hierarchical levels going on there that are continuously adjusting themselves. I mean, I don't want to bore you, but the brain as a kind of as a system is continuously monitoring how noisy, which means how bad the sensory input is, and the worse the sensory input is in terms of its quality, the more that what you're expecting determines what you experience. And then the clearer and crisper the sensory information is, then the less the expectation backs off then and says, oh no, the sensory input's very, very clear now. I'll allow it to determine what I expect even more strongly. And it's in a continuous state, like little dials, of trying to tune itself in to that sensory signal, like a radio signal. It's almost like the brain is attempting to resonate to what's coming in through the senses, and once it gets its dials right, it's like everything comes into focus. And oh yeah, got it. But that everything coming into focus is occurring every second. I mean, it's extraordinary. And, you know, our little frontal consciousness is sitting on top of this incredible event of every second. There's something making sense of the world for us. Now, and once again, I have to say, you see, because you fall into a kind of a materialistic trap here where you think the brain is doing it. But, of course, you've got to, at the same time, remember that the brain is just a collection of neurons. And the neurons have no what they're doing doesn't mean anything. What's happening for us is we experience the meaning of all of that activity. Do you see that if you take consciousness away, there's just a bunch of electrochemical signals interacting with each other inside the skull of in here. You know, there's no experience, there's no external world, there's no colour, there's nothing meaningful in that picture until I give it meaning. And the I that's giving it meaning is the... it's the mystery. You can't go from a bunch of neurons firing together, just, you know, sending little signals to each other, to an experience of being in the world. You know, there's just this enormous gap where we're looking in totally different dimensions. So I don't want to present the picture as if, now I've told you what the brain's doing, that explains experience, right? That doesn't explain experience, but it does say that what's happening in the brain is a kind of model of our experience. I'm sorry to drill on about this, but I spent many years in in this world where people were completely unable to see that there's a distinction between what's happening in your brain and your experience of living and being in the world. It's very easy to fall into this picture of the brain and say, oh, that's what's happening in the brain. Now I understand. But of course, it's absolutely incredible that all of that activity in the brain should turn into this experience I'm having now. I mean, this is my, in a way, this is the one question around which my entire professional life has circled. So coming back, I just like to leave that picture on one side, because I think as you carry on, you'll start to see more and more how what Heidegger's saying actually plays into this model of the brain. So I think I'm still on the first slide. I'm going about the same speed as usual, aren't I? Doesn't seem to have affected me at all, does it? So we've got to finish today, though, right? We have. We orientate. This is the third paragraph. We orient ourselves toward beings, and yet are never able to say what it is about beings that binds us, or what the possibility of such binding is grounded in on our part. For not all standing opposite necessarily entails binding. And when we speak of something standing opposite as an object, brackets the subject-object relation, consciousness, then the decisive problem has been preempted, not as posed at all. It's another great Heidegger sentence, isn't it? About around about the middle, you run out of steam. Irrespective of the fact that the objectivity of something standing opposite is neither the sole nor the primary form of binding. Now, I think if I can paraphrase that sentence, it's saying something like this, which he's been saying all along. As soon as we fall into a subject-object understanding of experience, we have left the immediate moment of the manifestation of what is, and we've started to reflect, and we've become a subject reflecting on an object, the object being our experience. And when Heidegger's talking about the logos apophantikos, he's talking about this too. As soon as we employ the logos apophantikos and we speak, we make assertions about experience, we've already stepped away from it and have made an object of it about which we can think and reflect. But in doing that, it's already presumed that something is manifest to us already. So this is Heidegger's big message, in a way. We live and think and speak and seem to fail to recognize that there's anything else but this linguistic subject-object mode of understanding. And he keeps on pointing out, but you see, what you're speaking of in all of this, all these crisp assertions that you're making, what you're speaking of is already unveiled to you. And in fact, you're already bound to it in a certain way. Although there's you know, the way that we use the logos apophantikos still has a power to highlight something and push something into the background. So it still has an effect on how the world is manifest to us. It's not as if you can take it apart and say it's something entirely separate, but it speaks out of and speaks into something that's already manifest, but the very action of our pointing something out in language, I've said it before, it's like passing a magnifying glass over what has been already manifest. It blows something up into our foreground attention. But the something that's being blown up in our reflection was already there. That's the picture. Now, I got to the end of it. Final sentence. Yet, however things stand in this respect, a binding character prevails throughout all being related to, all comportment toward beings. We cannot explain this binding character in terms of objectivity, but vice versa. So he's only saying there that this event of binding, of this holding yourself out towards something binding, has already occurred for us in order for us to be able to speak of it as if it were something objective and something separate from us. Because, of course, he's saying it's not something separate from us to begin with. All right, I'm going to the next slide, slide number 8. I'm going to do something, you know, because it's so silent that I usually don't do. Any questions? No questions, no questions. Maria, surely.
Oh, well, I did have a question, but I was just kind of trying to think about what you were saying. This, it seems to me that what he's saying about sort of binding and unbinding is not a conscious process. It's not something that we actively do. So, for instance, when I see the stick and I think it's a snake, so I'm kind of going, oh, snake, and then I go, oh no, stick. It's all kind of something that is happening anyway. It's not something I go home and go, I think that snake was actually a stick.
Yes. Yes.
It's not a conscious reflection, is what I'm saying. It's just something that happens automatically as
yes.
part of just existing in the world.
Yes. Yes. Are you reminding me that Husserl called it passive synthesis? It's a passive
right.
synthesis. Your egoic self, the one that that decides things, is not involved in it.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you are you have a certain power to bind and unbind in your imagination.
Yes.
Yeah. But in a way we're bound to the senses as if we have no choice, which is.
Mm.
But Heidegger's, I think, saying that, this is like Husserl as well. Husserl called it, you know, transcendental subjectivity. That, if you like, Heidegger would hate this. I'm sorry, Heidegger, that I should use Husserl's language, but I think it's one way of putting it. Transcendental subjectivity is doing the binding in perception. Yes, that there's a greater power behind our egoic little self. There's a power that's actually not just projecting or binding us to the world. There's a power that's actually projecting our little egoic self as a being in that world. So, yes, Julie.
Why is Anthony's sound off?
Anthony's sound is not off, is it?
It is on.
I turned my microphone off.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, that's because he's an IT guy. He doesn't want to cause interference.
No, I just saw it and then I thought, what, is there something wrong? Okay, sorry to interrupt.
He could turn himself on at any time. You know, he's a master of his own world. There, you know, that's it.
I have a question.
Yes, is that Alex?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this little egoic self, so is this a concept? Is this, like, what's the nature? Like, is my little egoic self a concept like any other concept that I create out of my experience?
Well, no, it's not. It's more than a concept, isn't it? Because I think for the greater part of our lives, in some way or other, we are bound to it, in the sense that we experience ourselves as being it. And there's another kind of binding involved in that. I mean, you have to go to it's almost, I think, you know, that's what meditation is, isn't it? Meditation is an attempt to unbind yourself from your egoic self. Unbind yourself is the wrong word. Just to become unbound from the egoic self and become a kind of a pure witness of the stream of experience. If you become a pure witness of the stream of experience, then all of the thoughts and the feelings that you ordinarily bundle together and say, this is me, just can become something that's just in the stream of consciousness. But disidentify, it almost says that like it's an action, but there's a falling away that's possible, where you it's almost like a relaxation of a certain focusing of attention that just falls back into the sheer consciousness of whatever is happening now. And in that falling back, there's a falling away from this kind of focused egoic consciousness. But it's almost, I wouldn't like to say that it was a concept, it's a kind of mode of being. Do you know, when you're in the mode, you're in that mode, right? And you need to be in that mode. It's not, I know that maybe there are some people who in the East who live in a cave all their life, who never actually come into the mode of being an egoic consciousness. But my experience is that we can move in and out. And insofar as you're in the egoic consciousness, is what I'm saying to Maria, we're utterly passive in the process of perception. But even if you come back, it's not as if when you come back, you suddenly get a new self that can control what you perceive. It's more like you're falling back into the place of a power that is doing the perceiving. You can't change it, because that would be an attempt of your egoic self to turn back on that power and say, all right, obey me. And of course, it won't obey, it can't obey, because in fact, you're emanating out of that place too. Is that too much?
No.
So we're always, I mean, we're cycling around this, you know, place where we're reflecting and in concepts about something that essentially all you can really do is withdraw. I feel, you know, that sort of hesitation. Like I'm speaking from this place of reflection, and in a way you almost can't help but get it wrong when you speak from there. But you have to rely on the goodwill of everyone who's listening to be able to relate what I'm saying back to a certain place where, you know, it's just, I mean, what we're trying to transpose ourselves into is the very moment of the manifestation of this moment I don't know if you can just... Yeah, I'm just looking at the computers, you know, machines that they are. There's something quite... It's not complex. What's happening here? As long as you're just, you know, you can almost feel it. As long as you're going out of your eyes and you just see the things around you, you miss the fact that they're manifesting out of something. Every moment. You know, we've been here before. If I get far enough down into it, I just start having this experience of my own voice manifesting like the computers. You know, it's just coming out. There's no one here doing it. You know, there's no little ego that's doing the speaking. Everything is, once you get back far enough, everything's just manifesting. In this is the transposition,
including your voice, huh?
It in a good moment. It's nice. It's nice. Do you know that there's two modes of speech? I don't know if you have you experienced this. There's a mode of speech when I'm doing the speaking here. Do you know? And there's a mode of speech where you start falling back into the moment, and there's just a voice emerging. You know, you do know it's your voice, but you're listening to it with interest to see what it's going to say. I mean, generally, you have to be saying something like this for it to happen. If you're saying, if you're discussing the shopping list in the supermarket, generally you don't have this kind of experience. Because you're fixed on what you're doing, on your egoic task, in a way. But the interesting thing here, of course, is we're not fixed on any egoic task, are we? So I'm lost again on this slide. Have I even started it?
No.
That's Nicolette in the background. I don't know if you can hear her. Maria, you're under a duvet there.
You might be.
You might be, yes.
Sorry, I just slipped out.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Boris, you're still... But every now and then, Boris, you should make a noise because we can't see you, but yeah, you're still there, I hope.
I'm here.
Yeah, good. So that we're on the slide, the missing origin. In all comportments, we become aware of comporting ourselves in each case from out of the as a whole. Oh, yeah. That's, you know, there are three moments, the binding, now we're into the as a whole. However, every day and restricted this comportment may be, we become aware of both holding ourselves towards something binding and completion in their unitary prevailing, even and indeed precisely wherever there is any conflict about an assertion's corresponding to what it establishes, or about whether a decision is fitting or an action essential. Now, I remember I wasn't absolutely sure what Heidegger was driving at here when he's talking about especially when we're in trouble. I mean, he likes to say this a lot. Things typically... I'm sorry, there's a very weird effect going on the screen here where the aerial coming out of Julie's radio is going through... is going through my image on the screen, and it looks like there's an aerial going through my head. Anyway, it's stopped now.
I just keep getting distracted by my family coming in and out because I'm in the kitchen.
Tell them to sit down and listen if they're troublesome. Tell them.
My husband's after the allotment. He's just giving me some tobacco before
I go. I hope it's tobacco, Julie.
No, it is tobacco. Yes, it is. The other makes me too.
Yeah, we don't want any of that. I don't know what he felt actually, but
clearly he must have I mean, people have been experimenting with things for a long time.
Yeah, maybe that was his secret when he went to his hut in Totnaborg in the black mountains, the Black Forest. Yeah, let's not consider that now. Where are we? Oh, yes. Yeah, Heidegger often says that the best way or manner in which to recognise the kind of phenomena going on in the background, the best way to recognise it is when there's some kind of breakdown.